Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're learning more about the world of glass blowing to begin the show today, including how it's used for science. And we'll talk about the history of the craft as well with our two guests. One of them, Helen Lee, is in the studio with me today. She's an artist, designer, educator, and glass blower, and head of glass in the art department at UW-Madison. Helen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Neil Corfidge, our other guest, he is head of the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry Glass Shop at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Neil repairs all types of glassware and equipment for teaching and research. Neil, great to have you with us as well.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
As we talk with these two experts, I hope you'll join in. Tell us about a time you watched a glassblower work, maybe. I think we've already got Connie in Portage online who wants to talk about that. What do you know about the history of glassblowing in Wisconsin? Who are some glass blowers that you admire, perhaps? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Neil, let's start with you. You're a scientific glass blower. So maybe to begin with, tell us what that really means.
Sure. So scientific glassblower means that the people I usually help are chemists. That's the number one kind of scientist that we help. So chemists usually work with reactions that involve liquids. And so in order to do a reaction that involves liquids, they need special equipment made from glass to be able to do those reactions. So we can make any kind of, for example, distillation setup for them, customized to their needs, so they can do their research in chemistry. And if it breaks, I can fix it. If they want a prototype that's never been made before, they can submit a drawing and I can make it. The sky is the limit, or the imagination is the limit with what I can make for them, or what they think will accomplish their research and their reaction.
So this is not the kind of thing you can call up the company that makes glass tubes for maybe work in chemistry, sort of standard tubes. This is really much higher end, let's put it that way.
Yes, it's more highly specialized stuff than the beakers and the test tubes and stuff. In fact, I get that a lot from people of, do you make the beakers and the test tubes? And I say, well, a little more complicated than that. It's more like condensers, multiple neck flasks, large columns, airless systems to get rid of oxygen, because oxygen reacts with everything. And it's really highly specialized stuff.
That is really cool. I want to turn to Helen. It's kind of a different approach here. You teach glass blowing as an art form.
I do.
How does the glass blowing process look different for artists?
Well, we have a slightly different toolkit in that Neil and scientific glass workers are mostly working on a tabletop mounted torch. And in our studios, we're working with larger furnaces. So it's more of our bodies moving around the space as opposed to sort of the hand arm scale work. And then there's quite a range of processes, which is true in scientific as well. But we're working hot, we're working warm, we're working cold. And I love how Neil introduced glass in the context of chemistry, because we actually hosted the scientific glassblower Tracy Dreyer last year in our facilities when his building was being renovated. And after 2 months, he said, okay, I've thought about it. And the difference between being here and being in chemistry is that in chemistry, they love chemistry, but here, you all really love glass.
Is that about right, Neil?
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree with that statement.
You know, Connie and Portage have been waiting a bit. Let's go there. Connie, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning. I have a couple. I blew glass myself. Before I became a nurse, I worked in a factory for Edelman in Illinois, and I blew the little glass tubes that go into batteries. But that's not the fun part. 20 years later, I went to Europe, and I got to go to Murano. And I bought some pieces of glass, watched them blow glass, And I then in Portage, Wisconsin, I found some Murano earrings. I couldn't believe it. So I bought those. So I love glass blowing.
Well, you know, there's Connie had a chance to see it being done. I have a daughter. We've spent a fair amount of time at Disney World, and you can watch at Disney World the artisans who are making maybe brooch type things or just standalone tabletop characters. And it really is a lot of fun, and probably, I don't know how many Disney employees, but I'm just wondering, from an artist, you're an artist, certainly. I'm just wondering about jobs. I mean, that would certainly be an interesting job, but what?
Yeah, well, I mean, even before that, just addressing the issue of the practice as a form of entertainment, there's quite a long history of that. Even if you go back to like late 1800s, early 1900s, there were kind of in the, I'm not going to say circus, but sort of like vaudevillian itinerant traveling entertainment groups that would share the practice with the public. We had a graduate student named Tyler Gordon who did some great research on this. And I think if you look at his website, Non-Crystalline History, you can look at some of these very old histories of glass making as entertainment. And today, even you don't even have to go to Disneyland. You can just open up your Netflix and watch a reality TV show on glass blowing. So it has a long history of entertainment for sure.
Yeah, it does indeed. I want to go back to tools for a bit. So, Neil, you use fire, but not in the same way that Helen uses it.
Yeah, correct. Yes, my two main tools for let's just say melting glass or fusing glass. She mentioned the bench torch. That's correct. Right now, I use a device called a Carlisle CC burner from Carlisle Machine Works in Melville, New Jersey. It's like sitting at a desk, having the torch in front of you, and then I can adjust the flame to a very, very small flame pinpoint, almost like a laser, to something really large and lots of heat being put out. So that's the first flame tool. The other tool that I use is I use a glass working lathe, and attached on the glass working lathe are these hand torches that I can just hold in one hand and adjust the knobs with one hand to the flame that I need. So the glass working lathe turns the glass as I'm working it. You know, it grabs the glass, turns it when I turn on the lathe, and then I use the hand torch to make whatever seals that I want. So those are my two main tools.
That's pretty good. So there's a bit of machinery. You've got a lathe, but it's still it comes down to the ability, the artistic ability, perhaps, I guess I could say, of the person doing the glass blowing.
Sure, there's a lot of finesse involved in what I do, and it really, it's very little textbook learning or book learning. There are books on scientific glass blowing. There's not very many, like maybe a couple, but being trained for it and learning how to do it well is just almost like a mentorship is the best situation. And I actually had that with my previous employer, Millipore Sigma. I did an apprenticeship program with them after I left Salem Community College in New Jersey, which is where I got my formal training. So my mentor at Millipore Sigma was so helpful in teaching me how to be really good at this.
So how does the process look? It looks certainly a lot different from a different kind of artist, because I think the scientific part is art as well, but a different kind of art.
Yeah, so it is slightly different. A lot of the principles are similar. Neil mentioned that he has a lathe to turn the glass to keep it really symmetrical. In the case of furnace working, it's my hands that are turning the pipe to keep everything really symmetrical. So that translation happens. And then also, whereas in scientific glass blowing, there's kind of like a pointed, focused torch that's applied, or heat that's applied to the glass. In the case of furnace work, I retrieve my glass from a giant 1,000-pound furnace full of hot glass. And once it's on my stick, it's going to start cooling from 2150 Fahrenheit down to room temperature. And all I'm doing in furnace work is I'm kind of interrupting that cooling curve and continually reheating it so I can keep it in this working range so that I can shape it. And so rather than the heat source being a point source of heat, I'm putting the glass into a reheating chamber that's sort of like a heat environment.
So the glass, when it comes out of the oven, it's of a consistency of lava.
honey is a good one.
Honey is the better. Yeah.
So the furnace is holds everything at a critical heat, and I often use the metaphor of honey. Even actually when I teach glassblowing, sometimes before students gather for the first time, I'll just have them practice with honey or something similarly viscous.
Very interesting. But maybe, Neil, maybe you can talk about the science behind glass blowing. What happens to glass as it heats up?
Well, the same thing with what she was talking about was the glass I start with, for example, is tubing of all kinds of diameters. Usually it's measured in metric, like millimeters. Let's just say 45 millimeter diameter tubing. It comes in 4-foot lengths. But I can get tubing that's as small as 2 millimeter all the way to 6 or 8 inch pipe, and it's all manufactured on the East Coast in those furnaces. And then I get it through the mail, and then I use it to build the things that I need to build.
I'm thinking about getting something through the mail. I'm going back to a story that I had a friend who's Christmas tree ornament, which was about a 6-7 inch high deer, a glass made of glass that was from the 40s, I think, and the husband dropped it and broke it. And so I happened to have a friend in Arizona at the University of Arizona who had I was telling him about it. He said, I've got a friend here who's a glassblower at the university. Maybe he can make you another one as a gift. So I sent a photo, and he sends back this intricate. And he was, I think his position was normally or sort of like yours, Neil. But he did a marvelous job, and it just absolutely amazes me, the legs, the antlers, the small, and then I'm just absolutely amazed at how that can be put together. I mean, is it all done in, Helen? Antlers and legs and all that. I mean, do they do that all in one step?
No, it doesn't happen all in one step. But at the same time, it can be, especially with solid sculpting. I'm not sure if this object was solid or hollow, but it's quite stunning to watch solid sculptors, because just with a few gestures, it can really be astonishing how quickly you can arrive at a recognizable form. So it's you go step by step,
Talking today with Helen Lee, artist, designer, educator, glassblower, head of glass in the art department at UW-Madison. And then we go over to the UW-Milwaukee for Neil Corfidge, our other guest. He heads the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry Glass Shop at UW-Milwaukee. Questions for him, or maybe an experience to share as it relates to glass. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trina LaSusa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're talking about glass blowing, how glass blowing fuses art, it fuses science, and we've got history involved here. We got a whole lot going on with our two guests, Helen Lee, artist, designer, educator, head of glass at the art department at UW-Madison. Neil Corfidge heads the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry Glass Shop at UW-Milwaukee. He repairs all types of glassware and equipment, makes new pieces for teaching and for research. Again, questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Jeff in Berry Mills. Jeff, hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to relate. When I was a kid, and I'm 70 plus years old now, there was a guy that did a show in La Crosse that he made a little swan out of glass that had a hole in it, and you could fill it partially full of water, and it acted as a barometer. The colored water would go up into the neck of the swan as the air pressure changed. And I was just wondering if you'd make me one and send it this way.
Well, Neil, have you ever made one of those?
I think I tried it once. I'm very limited when it comes to artistic glass blowing. My forte is actually icicles. I can make icicles all day long for Christmas tree ornaments or just for art. My dad, actually, I'm a second generation glass blower. My dad originally taught me, and my dad could make stuff like ships with like three masts and Mickey Mouse figurines. And in addition to the scientific stuff, you know, his professional job was a scientific glass blower, but then he could do that other stuff. So swan for him would be like nothing. He could just whip it up in like 10 minutes.
Well, Helen?
I've seen them made. This is more of a scientific torch or flame scale item than a furnace item. But I've never made one of those.
It does sound pretty cool. So when the barometer is falling, the glass, the water goes back down to the body of the swan, I suppose. And when it's rising, it pushes it up the neck of the swan.
Yeah,
we actually have a sample of one in a display case. Our scientific glassblower in Madison, Tracy Dreyer, made one for a demo for one of our classes. So we do have one on display.
Does it work?
Yeah.
That's great. Jeff, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Jeff probably wants to know where he can buy one of those. No? I'm not seeing from either one of our guests where a person might buy something like that. So we'll just move on, Jeff. Thanks for calling. Julie in Lincoln, Nebraska. It's your turn. Hi, Julie.
Well, hi, Larry. So I'm calling because the gal that just mentioned as a glass blower at UW is not the person who I worked with, but while I was working at UW-Madison, we had a rather complicated distillation set up with three-necked 1-liter flasks and all the connections to bubble nitrogen through them and then condensing up into an alene condenser. And I got to tell you that's expensive equipment. Those condensers are, you know, the one I used was fairly small. It was only 18 inches long. Some of them get to be even bigger than that. So they have all these different connections with proper angles so that you can bubble the gas off of whatever you're cooking in that 3-liter or that 1-liter flask. And then, instead of having to buy a whole new condenser or pieces, you could take it to the glass blower and have them create a new connection so that you could put tubing on it or, repair the tip on the end of a that you were bubbling into with. You know, anyway, I can imagine it. It's been a number of years since I've done that sort of work, but I got to tell you, glass blowers are really important in the scientific community. And so thanks to all you guys who do that.
Oh, well, Julie, thanks a lot. Yeah, Neil, go ahead.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much. I love the work I do here in our society for the American Scientific Glassblower Society. We're so happy to service chemists and the whole scientific community. It's very fun for us.
So give me an example. And her comment about the generator, did she say?
Condenser.
Yeah, the condenser. Have you ever had to do that? Fix one of those? Neil?
Oh, absolutely. I've made them. I've fixed them. There's all kinds of different style condensers. She mentioned Allen. Allen condensers are pretty skinny. They're very low profile. There's another condenser called a Liebig, which is fatter. You know, it takes in more water for the cooling jacket. There's like about a dozen different styles, and so yeah, they're very fun to make. It's a standard item.
And I don't know how long ago this individual was here, but Joe Wheeler would have been the scientific glassblower prior to Tracy Dreyer.
Julie, do you remember?
I don't remember the name, but I was there from 1979 until 1987. So somewhere in there.
That would be my guess, that maybe Joe Wheeler was involved.
Julie, thanks. Thanks so much for joining in. Wayne in Prairie du Sac has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Wayne.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Wayne Youngblood. I was just happened to catch part of the conversation as I was in the car. But I had a question. Back when I was in college in the late 70s, we had a brand new glass studio come in, and of course, I fell in love with glass blowing. My professor had studied under Harvey Littleton and others, and art glass was still fairly new, and at least I felt at the time our tools were relatively primitive, although we got a lot of wonderful pieces out of it. But after having been away from the art for a number of years, several years ago, I visited a glass studio, and I was amazed at the advances, everything from the blowing rods to shaping tools and everything else. And I was just kind of wondering what her perspective is on the rapid advance of the tools in art glass blowing.
Oh, thanks, Wayne, for calling. And, well, probably both Helen and Neil could comment, but Helen, let's go to you.
Yeah, well, I think there's two things happening. One, you're right that a whole niche industry cropped up around, you know, the advent of the American studio glass movement, and there were custom tool manufacturers who made really nice pipes and punties and all of those really awesome tools that we get to work with. But at the same time, the general overall design of the tools are still pretty primitive, you know? And so there's something quite delightful about that. And I would say if you look at like the 80s and the 90s, another major influence that happened was the Americans kind of reconnecting with the Venetian style and influence of how they worked, and the kind of like acquisition of skill as one benchmark to strive for was definitely a major trend then. And so probably when you revisited it, you were kind of catching the field when it had gone through that transition.
And the, just to follow through, the when did the glass blowing, and you talked a little bit about the history, but when did glass blowing begin, really?
Well, blowing itself as an art form, I think that gets credited to the Syrians around like 100, 200, or 300 BC-ish. And I mean, prior to that too, just working with the material, I think often gets credited to the Egyptians, and that's even older, like 1500 BC. So we're talking about like a very old art form. But yeah, that would be in terms of humanity.
Yeah. So what did they make? Cups and
vessels of some sort. And there was core forming too, where rather than blowing, you would have a solid, you know, mass of clay or something on a mandrel, and then you would wrap the glass around it to make a vessel. So there's sort of different ways of achieving a vessel form.
Yeah. Neil, a comment from you?
What was the question?
You may not have the history. I should probably ask Helen, at least in terms of the university.
Oh.
Because I think the UW.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about that. yeah, well, so we're really well known, and this individual who called in is a part of this tradition where UW-Madison was the first academic glass program in the nation, and it was spearheaded by Professor Emeritus Harvey Littleton. So that was 1962, and I guess my spin on the story was what is remarkable about that is that it put the skill of glassblowing in the hands of artists. And so, you know, even as we're having this talk, Neil is situated in the sciences, I'm situated in the arts, but it's also the case, at least at Madison now, you know, the second glassblower in the chemistry department is a graduate of the art department in the glass lab. And so the hand skills are exactly the same. But there are also longer histories of glass that are really important at UW-Madison. They go all the way back really to the founding of the university. I think the first kind of really historic incident of glass on UW campus is Edward Burr's purchasing invertebrate specimens from the Blaschka brothers, who were famous glassblowers that made scientific specimens that were really sought after by universities in that day because, unlike preserved specimens, they retained their color and they retained their form. So that was sort of the pinnacle of scientific specimens and learning materials then. So that's like the 1890s that was part of the University of Wisconsin-Madison's history with glass.
Oh, my goodness. Do you know, Neil, what was the UW-Milwaukee's history on this? How long have you been going on?
I've been here for 17 years. My predecessor's name is Bob Ponton. He was here for about, 25 years. So the glassware before him, I think, was the first one here, if I'm not mistaken about that. So this building is about 50 years old. In fact, we're getting a brand new chemistry building that we're moving into this February. It's like about 80%, 90% complete. So I would say that as far as the glassware being here at UWM, it's probably started about 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, and at UW-Madison, that first glassblower that was hired was closer to 1917, I believe, with the advent of radio being invented, which was reliant on the fabrication of a vacuum tube, which was fabricated in glass.
That's how we got Wisconsin Public Radio on the air.
Yep.
9XM was the first.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because if you look back on all of the commemorative murals celebrating this really critical invention, you'll see in the bottom left-hand corner of the mural, the glassblower is included as like a key player in that invention.
Well, it had to be.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Scott in New Berlin, we go to you. Hi, Scott.
Yeah, hi, Larry and Jess. Back in the mid-70s, I worked at a GE plant that made the tubing for fluorescent lamps. And it was pretty interesting how it was made. It obviously a big kiln that had this big thing called a sleeve, a big ceramic thing, maybe 4 or 5 feet long and 18, 20 inches in diameter. It would rotate very slowly and they would pour the glass on it and they would blow air down the middle of it. And you'd pull the glass off the end of the sleeve and then they'd have a run, maybe 100 feet long and with the glass running down this thing at such and such speed, and you controlled the air pressure and the speed to get the different diameters of tubing that you'd need. And the way they would cut it, they had a ring of fire near the end that would travel along with the glass, get a spot hot, and then a little shoe with cold water going through it, it would break. So I just thought I'd throw that out there for comments, and that's how they make glass tubing. Fluorescent lamps.
Oh, Scott, thanks a lot for calling. Comments? Helen, maybe?
Well, I mean, we've been talking a lot about, glass blowing as entertainment and the kind of spectator aspect of it, but watching industrial glass get made is equally fascinating. It's incredible. I've seen similar type tubing made in Corning, and it just the scale of it is mind-blowing.
Yeah. Neil?
Yeah, I toured a Corning factory once when I was in school in New Jersey. We took a trip out to the actual factory that made the glass tubing, and it was like a foundry. It's like steel and hot and the furnaces, and there's just this continual pull of tubing that's coming out of the furnace to be able to ship it to people like me. And so the words that the caller used to describe how the tubing was made me think about my experience at the Corning factory when I was looking at some of the ways that they made tubing.
It's really, and he was talking about forcing air into the tube as it went along as an adjustment. And I bet you both use your own breath or use your own air at times in the making. Neil, comment.
Sure. So when people ask me, do you blow the glass? The technical answer is yes, there is blowing in the glass, but it's very, very small puffs. So whenever I heat the glass in the lathe, as soon as it starts to melt, it starts to collapse. So I don't want it to collapse. in most operations. So I just keep it, you know, at a sort of equilibrium, you know, its original diameter, just to pull against the puff against that collapsing. But it's not heaves. It's not like giant breaths where you take in a big breath and then blow with all your might. It's not like that at all.
It's like a like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, it's a little puff. Little puffs, or just keep the air pressure in there a little bit, and then that's it, just to keep the wall thickness the same.
Oh, man, there's got to be an art to that. Helen, comment?
Yeah, well, you want to think about heat, too, and I think that's sort of the element that gets overlooked in thinking about blowing, and the blowing aspect gets really dramatized a lot, but it's in relationship to the heat, and so, you know, if the blowing becomes difficult, that's an indicator that you don't have enough heat going on, so those things are kind of related.
Oh, man, this is really interesting. A listener emailed us. They had the opportunity a number of years ago to visit the studio of Dale Chihuly, the Boathouse, in Seattle. And while there, they were able to see glass blowers executing Chihuly's designs. It was magnificent, like a well-choreographed dance. They understand that Chihuly got his start at UW-Madison, and that is true. Helen, you want to?
Yeah, he did move through this program for certain, and he was the one that sort of spearheaded the RISD glass program following this. You know, from this program grew like a dozen or so other programs around the nation, and from those programs grew all of the programs around the nation, which probably had their heyday in like the 90s, early 2000s. That number is now shrinking. Yeah, and he definitely, not just him, but all glassblowers, especially glassblowers working in that furnace studio environment, there's definitely an art form to it in terms of it being a type of a dance or a choreography. In my teaching practice, I definitely think of it more as a movement-based practice rather than an object-making discipline.
Yeah. Neil, comment?
I saw one documentary on Chihuly, and it was amazing. I mean, his whole team that works with him. Yeah, it really is like a dance or a movement where as soon as that glass comes out of the furnace and they have the specific goal of making some shape or sculpture, several people jump into action with different tools. And because the what they're making can be heavy, it requires, you know, support from not just one person sometimes. And then they got to get it into an oven, you know, for it to anneal once they're done working on it. So, yeah, I can totally relate to that. It seems like a dance or a movement to make sculpture pieces like that.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I mean, another important thing about the partnered glassblowing, too, in furnace work is that it is amazing to watch a team like Chihuly's work, but also, like, even a beginner student now is working with a partner, and there's a choreography. And so it's just nice that it exists throughout the spectrum of different types of artists that are practicing in glass.
Yeah, I was thinking back because I was on the athletic board at UW and I chaired the building committee at the time the Cole Center was built. And, of course, Dale Chihuly created, I think they called it, he called it Mendota, a wall hanging for the Cole Center that was, if I'm not mistaken, 140 feet long. And about 6 feet in width at various points. It's a fabulous piece of work. And I think he donated a good share of it sort of in honor of the UW and his as being here as a student. It's a beautiful. Kay in Berlin, your turn. Hi, Kay.
Thank you for taking my call, Larry. I appreciate it. I was just commenting, as a teenager, now I'm in my 70s now, I visited the Greenfield Village around the Henry Ford Museum to watch the glass blowers, and that was the most fascinating thing I've ever seen. And they put out some of the most beautiful pieces for us while we were there. It was like a senior skip day type thing, but it was awesome.
You know, that's the comment we've heard pretty much everybody who called, who's watched it, their observation. What an awesome experience to watch it in action.
It's very alluring.
Very alluring. And someone else wants to know, Neil, what was the hardest project that you've had to do?
Oh, so I used to work at MilliporeSigma, you know, the chemical company. has 12 glass blowers working there, and they do large scale reactions. So well over, sometimes well over like 5 gallons, so 50 liters actually. So they came to us with a problem. The chemists came to us with a problem. We want a big, super big reaction vessel so we can do this reaction in this one vessel so that we don't have to transfer it out to make room for more volume. That's the short story. So what we ended up doing was we took a 72 liter flask, which is ginormous.
Yeah.
And we took a 22 liter flask and we sealed them both together in a giant K-size lathe. It took me and my mentor both to man the fires to seal these two flasks together to basically make what's called a giant separatory funnel, wide on the top, narrow in the bottom that goes to a valve. So we had to wear these things I call astronaut suits. It is an apron made out of Kevlar woven cloth that has a coating on the outside that looks like aluminum and it reflects heat. And we wore these face masks that were basically like your screen for your porch, made out of steel or something, some kind of metal, so that the heat wouldn't melt us. Right? It would reflect the heat back to the machine. And then we could stand there with torches in hand and the carriage fire going and make this big, gigantic circle seal to seal together a 72-liter flask and a 22-liter flask. So at the end, once this thing was all done, the maintenance department had to construct a mobile scaffolding for it so that it could be pushed around on wheels, you know, on the scaffolding, because it was too big for one person to carry. It was much too heavy. And yep. So that's sweating bullets there.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. Helen, do you have an intricate piece or something that stands out in your mind?
It's funny listening to Neil, you know, talk about this sort of Herculean feat of making that hot seal, because I think in my practice, it's more like an endurance sport for some of my projects. So I have this one project that's a cabinet of glass type. I designed a typeface that was 5 pixels by 5 pixels. And so it exists as a digital typeface, but then I made it in glass too, in Marini form. But I made a type case of it in the style of letterpress type cases. And so technically speaking, I'm going to estimate there's about 10,000 pieces of glass letters in that piece. It was like a 2-year project. And yeah, so that's what I mean, where it's sort of like, you know, and I guess I should say too, that I'm making glass in the service of my artistic studio practice, which is maybe a little different than sort of like making functional work. So yeah, the nature of the challenges sometimes change scope.
This has been fascinating talking with both of you. My goodness, we're out of time, but I want to thank you both so much. It's been great fun, and maybe we can do this again down the road. Neil, thank you so much. Helen, thank you as well.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome very much. Thank you for having me.
Helen Lee, artist, designer, educator, glassblower, head of glass in the art department at UW-Madison, and Neil Corfidge heads the Department of Chemistry and Biochemistry glass shop at UW-Milwaukee. It's really fun to have them both with us, and it'd be fun to do it again with them. A couple of other artists coming up. They're artists of weather and climate, I guess we could call it. The Weather Guys next. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network.